It's not, now my hand is salty.
Hello and welcome to Negative Space, the podcast where art students talk about art. Today we're going to talk about some art that we've seen just recently.
And Lindsay's made some really strange
hand gestures there. Hi, I'm Sam.
I'm Simone.
And we have our wonderful guest back, Lindsay.
Hi guys, I'm Lindsay Ting, and today I'm wearing pants.
Wow.
What amazing.
An amazing development. I'm so proud of, we're all proud of you, Lindsay, really.
I'm not that proud. don't get in over your head.
So today we went on an adventure.
It could be called that.
We went all the way to the LA County Museum of Art. We actually went specifically to the LACMA to see an exhibit that's going on right now and is going to be running all the way through the end of Thanksgiving break, and it's the Guillermo del Toro exhibit. I think the exhibit itself is called something Monsters.
Let me pull it up. I think it was like At Home with Monsters.
Yeah, At Home with Monsters. And essentially the exhibit is not only a collection of props themselves from original concept art, maquettes and stuff from his movies, but it's also a lot of really cool work from his personal collection. Mm-hmm. Original Mike Mignola drawings from like Hellboy, a bunch of, he has for some reason tons of original concept art from old Disney films. If you are in the LA area and you have an opportunity to go to the LACMA to see this exhibit,
highly recommended.
Highly, 10 out of 10.
Like, he also has a bunch of cool ukiyo-e paintings, so if you're into that,
yeah.
He's got a bunch. He's got all the ones with skeletons in them. So, you know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
And if you've read the books, Spooky Stories to Tell at Night, he has a few of those paintings as well.
Oh, yeah, the illustrations.
Yeah.
Those are great.
I don't know what's going on with that movie. You should look it up.
I mean, the last I saw, it was like a really recent article that people were talking about, like him starting to work on it.
Yeah.
Or at least the process of him working on it, so.
Yeah, anyway, it's a great, great exhibit. You do, if you go, you do have to reserve times ahead of time. Or not ahead of time, but if you go, they have time slots because it's such a, I think it's so in demand that they break it into time chunks so they don't have too many people in the exhibit at once. So you should plan for that ahead of time if you do want to go. What was your guys' favorite part of the exhibit, do you think?
Oh, man. It's hard. I really liked seeing all of the costume designs for Crimson Peak.
Yeah.
The best designed, worst movie ever.
Yeah, we're going to get back to that because that is actually our second topic of this podcast.
Yeah.
Lindsay, what do you think was your favorite part?
I actually really loved all of the creatures that were there. Like, he has a birdpede, which is a bird centipede.
Birdipede.
Yeah, it's literally called the Birdpede 2.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's like Sharknado 2.
Exactly. So there was that, and he has just a bunch of, like, various random creatures. Like, he has, like, some mermaid one that was, like, that I took a picture of. And, like, he has one of the parasites, a model of a parasite from, Pacific Rim.
I think that's actually a screen used one. That's the one, if you remember in the movie where they go to that, what's his name? It's Hannibal something, but he's the guy, the black market guy who sells
Not Hannibal
parts.
Burris or Lecter.
No.
Neither of those.
But he's, if you watch in the background, there's one single shot where a guy, like a lab assistant, walks by holding one of them and it's crawling and like moving. I think that's the actual one that is the screen used one, because there's only like one shot in the whole movie where you get to see it moving.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think that is what the actual prop is. They have it there. Yeah, there's tons of sculptures, maquettes, stuff from his movies and stuff that I guess he just like sees stuff and he buys it.
Yeah.
Like there's all sorts of like, you know, there's like weird like steampunk cabinetry.
Yeah.
And like little geary things or like sculptures
it seems drawing. Like in his own house he would like create this like weird world,
yeah,
you know, like that's just kind of the impression that it gives off from the collection that was brought in from the like random stuff that's around his house.
Yeah,
it's definitely a spookier kind of exhibit. It's not like a fine art like, oh, look at this painting.
Yeah
it's kind of it's kind of corny in a way, and it, you know, but it's also creepy. It's great.
Mm-hmm. I think it's more relevant than, like, a lot of other art exhibits. Like, as art students, like, a lot of the time we can go to a museum and, like, appreciate some things that maybe other people don't. But, like, this, like, anyone can go and they can be like, whoa, that's really cool, because it's really relevant to, like, modern day. Where, like, sometimes you, like, look at a Renaissance painting and you're like, well, what, you know?
It's like, oh, it's Jesus again.
Yeah. Oh, man. People sure do love their Christianity. There's that one part of the exhibit that, I don't know, it wasn't even, I think, part of the exhibit itself. It was just really funny to me that they had a sketching room to the side.
I don't know why it was there.
I don't either.
But I saw a lot of people in there, so I think they were getting something out of it. But, like, there were no, like, instructions, like, you know, create your own monster or anything. They're just like, yeah, we got some paper in here and some clipboards, but you can't take them out into the exhibit to draw anything.
Yeah.
They're just in this white room that doesn't match the rest of the exhibit at all.
I don't know what was up with that.
I don't know. Actually, I looked in there, and, like, I was staring at them. I was like, oh, I think this is, like, some special class that they're doing, so.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think they would probably do, like, presentations or something, because I think there was, like, a sheet with times.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, it was just a room with a bunch of paper, and you could, like, hang out there and draw.
It had a strong AC going on there.
It was super cold. Yeah. I don't even remember.
You know, but, like, I mentioned that I like the Crimson Peak dresses, but more specifically, I like the one for the mom, like, because it had those, in the fabric, in the sheer fabric, it had a bunch of, like, moths and stuff, like, kind of trapped in it, and it looked really cool. Like, I saw that, and I was like, I would wear that dress.
Those are, like, the only actual original costumes that were there, right? Because there wasn't anything else. All the
there's
models... There was a Pacific Rim suit, and that was it. But I noticed it was interesting, a lot of the models that were there, like the Pale Man. And
they were just like statues.
There were statues, but they were, if you read the plaques, they were actually reproductions of, so they weren't actually from the movies. They were just, they hired some like artists or sculptors to reproduce them, I think probably especially for the exhibit or for his private collection. I was listening to this one lady talk, it was really funny. I don't know if this is true or not, but she was saying that she was reading an interview with Guillermo del Toro, he was talking about how he kind of misses having all this stuff in his house, so every once in a while he has to come to the actual exhibit and see all of his stuff.
Let's see.
I don't know if it's true. We'll probably have to look it up. But if it's true, that'd be really, really cute.
You know what? Like, other than that dress, there was a giant Frankenstein head that just hangs above a doorway, it's awesome. I took a couple pictures of it. Mm-hmm. And there's also, God, there's statue of the angel from Hellboy in the entryway. And, like, it was too bad that was, like, the introduction, because that was, like, really cool. And it was kind of, like, out of the... Like, it was kind of more of a display.
Yeah, you had to be either in or out in order to see it. So it wasn't, like, part of the exhibit exactly. It was kind of just at the entrance. And I can understand why they put it there to, like,
people
walk
by and see
it.
Of course,
because it would draw. And then they would go into it. But, yeah. Anyway, so I think Lindsay and I did some drawings. Simone, you forgot your sketchbook.
I left my sketchbook at home, and I was sad and took a lot of pictures.
I was really sad that they put a lot of the really cool creatures and, like, smaller models on top of all the bookshelves.
Yeah, that was kind of sad.
Yeah, so they had a bunch of Pacific Rim kaiju maquettes that were, like, on top of the bookshelf, or, like, you can't really see them that well.
Yeah.
That was sad. I think they probably might have even run out of space. Mm-hmm. Like, it was pretty packed in there.
It was. It was definitely.
Yeah. Guillermo
del Toro has a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah.
I would have just loved a room just for Pacific Rim and just for, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, if
you
it was
know, specific themed. Parts.
The one thing about the exhibit that was a little... That threw me off a little bit is that it's kind of hard to navigate. Like...
Yeah, I got lost a little, but I think that...
It's probably part of the
idea.
Yeah,
that was probably intentional.
But, like, half of it was like, yeah, like, it's cool. You kind of get lost and you, like, go your own way. And it's, like, it's not, like... doesn't have arrows on the floor or anything telling you where to go. But at the same time, I was like, I feel like maybe I missed something.
I know.
Like,
I don't know
which
doorway
I've gone
stuff.
Through yet.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Yeah, I walked by it like three or four times. And only on the last time, I figured out that there was like a small little part where more paintings were.
Yeah,
like, I saw that.
And I was like, if I hadn't walked here three times, I literally would have missed this.
We spent a long time in there. We spent like an hour and a half. I don't think they actually expected people to spend that long in there.
Yeah.
Because I know they were, like, counting people in, right? And the whole time I was thinking, oh, they probably expected us to be out of here by now.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the Crimson Peak costumes were pretty incredible.
I love the bloodstained, like, nightdress.
Yeah.
That it just feels good.
Sort of rubbing your hands together in glee. And, I mean, we all went to go see Crimson Peak together. Almost exactly a year ago.
We were
like, oh, man, we should hang out for Halloween. And so we all got together and we went to go see Crimson Peak on Halloween night because it was like, oh, a horror movie. And I gotta say, we all went in expecting it to not be incredible, and I think that is what made the experience so good.
Yeah, we all knew what we were getting into. We knew exactly what it was going to be going in. I think I did, at least. I think Lindsay did. I'm not sure about Chelsea.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, I had read some reviews or something, and it was like, what? Like,
yeah.
It was Guillermo del Toro, but it was also like, for like a 15-year-old fan fiction or something.
Yeah, it was just like, it's those girls that like, you know, really like to read, and they're really like into how much they like to read and how like intellectual they are.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Anyways.
And it totally was.
Yeah.
And that kind of made it more amazing.
But, you know, we all went into that with that, you know, mindset already, and I think it made it easier for us to appreciate how beautiful that movie was.
It was really like, funny, though.
So dumb. Super, super, super dumb.
If you just like, take out all the plot, it's
just gorgeous. But it doesn't have any already.
Oh, that's very true.
Oh, man.
I mean,
like, the plot was incest. That was the plot.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Oh.
If you haven't
seen, do you really care that much about
it? I mean,
we should put a spoiler alert in the title. That should be the title of the episode.
Crimson Peak spoilers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're gonna talk about the movie now, so if you haven't seen the movie and you don't want to be spoiled for it,
I guess.
Then you should go and watch it, but keep in mind that really, it's, don't watch it for the plot, watch it for how beautiful it is.
Just ignore what they're saying and pay
attention. Don't ignore what they're saying, pay extra attention so that you can get the most comedic, like, value out of it, because that movie is so funny.
Oh,
it is hilarious.
The most comedic thing, I think, was when she was opening that one drawer and then the face popped out, but the facial expression was just off just by that much that I couldn't stop laughing at it.
And you know, we were in a theater full of people too, and other people were also trying really hard not to laugh.
Yeah.
And you know, the best part was when she... Okay, spoiler alert, at the end, the sister stabs Tom Hiddleston in the face, right? And that was the only time that I ever heard the crowd actually, like some people were like, ew, gross. And then, like, after she stabbed him in the face, some people started laughing. I could hear it.
It's just, like, you
it's
know...
It's just too much.
You know that the movie is, like, bad good when you can hear the theater fart.
Yeah.
Like, there's that, like, noise that people make when they're... They're trying not to laugh out loud, but it was just
fart.
So unexpected.
It's a mouth fart.
Yeah.
A mouth fart. But, wow. So, the costume design for Crimson Peak, I don't actually know. I should look this up. But the costume design was incredible. It's, like, it's a period piece, so all of the, like, dresses and the suits and stuff are all these really elaborate period costumes with, like, huge, puffy shoulder sleeves.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
And the set design...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the manor with the staircase and, like, all of the architecture, this, like, really, you know, like, dark gothic.
The whole thing, by the way, we already said spoilers so many times. The rest of, like, the segment where we're talking about Crimson Peak is gonna be spoilers.
Yeah.
Let's just, like, leave it at that. The whole thing with, the clay in the ground, the red clay, where it was like, it's, like, blood. And it's, you know, it's stupid, but it still looks really good.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really be that mad at it.
Super cliche, but at the same time, it was like, I guess
it looked
nice.
Works
with the movie.
Yeah. I think a lot, like, along with that, though, it also had a really great color palette to it.
Mm,
like, in the first few seconds, you've just got that orange and blue and green.
And that,
colors.
Like, dress she's wearing, that's, like, that deep golden yellow. I'm sad that they didn't have that dress because I really wanted to see that one in person.
Yeah.
But
I really like the nightdress, and if just for, like, the bloodstain, like, kind of, I guess that was clay, I think?
I don't remember.
I think it was clay.
It's just, like, the way that looks, I don't know, it kind of gives off a Bloody Mary vibe. It's really neat.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the color scheme. Like, the first second going in it, like, the first 10 seconds, like, it just starts out with, like, beautiful colors. Like, it's just, right out the gate, you look at it and you're like, oh, this is gonna be a great movie. Like, this color,
this guy knows what he's
amazing.
Doing.
Yeah.
And then it takes you on a wild ride of incest and, like, 15-year-old fantasy love.
It was like a Twilight movie, but if Twilight looked really good.
Yeah.
You know? And the thing about it is, Like, because we're talking about how good it looks visually, but I don't think it even looked that great cinematically. I think it was just, like, the designs in the movie that were the best.
I don't know, I wasn't really paying attention to the cinematography. Yeah, the cinematography is just, like, the design behind it. Like, mm-hmm. whoever was his art director, his production designer, yeah. his costume designer, like, wow.
yeah, he knows what he's doing
when yeah. it comes to that. Just gotta hire a screenwriter who's just as good.
Yeah.
Buddy.
It definitely felt like they put all their budget into designing the yeah. set and the costuming. And then the color palette, which is mm-hmm. beautiful, but when the plot doesn't hold up, it's...
Yeah, you know, yeah. and you know, we would... If there was a good movie, if we called a movie a good movie, it could have bad design, but still be a good movie, and we'd call it a good movie.
Sometimes design has a heavy, like, if it's bad, it has a pretty harsh blow to the film itself, though.
I mean, do you think the plot is more important than the design when it comes to calling a movie a good movie?
Of course, yes.
I think...
But that also goes hand in hand with cinematography and stuff, because that is, like, part of the storytelling, right? It's a mm-hmm. visual medium. It's a visual audio medium. And each half is equally as important.
Yeah.
So...
But I feel like when it comes to movies, you gotta get the story right.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
And if it's yeah. not right... It's, you know,
that's... Yeah, that just, like, totally destroys it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing that you were saying earlier about the screenwriter, like, how, you know, because I don't think that... I'm gonna sound like a total ass...
Go ahead.
...here, because I don't remember that much about Del Toro movies. But usually, Del Toro tends to try to, like, do his own stuff, right? The shame with, like, if any of you are into video games, like, Silent Hills, that was Kojima and Del Toro working together, and... You know, Kojima's a guy that's really good with story, and Del Toro is somebody that's really good with like, ambience. Ambience. That was, like, a combination of ambiance and ambience. I prefer ambience, personally. That was the one case where I thought it was really all coming together, because every time I see a Del Toro movie, I'm like, you know, this looks really cool, and I like the concepts, and I like the designs, and I like the sort of, like, world that those movies, like, the vibe that those movies give off, mm-hmm. but... As a movie itself, I'm generally not that impressed by the plot, mm-hmm. right? It's the sort of thing where, like, you think about it, like, it's the sort of thing that you'll see in your dreams, and you'll think it's really interesting, but your dream doesn't really have a plot,
mm-hmm.
so...
Yeah. And we just looked this up, the production designer is Thomas E. Sanders, and I guess he also did Braveheart, so that's pretty... That was our topic for today. We're also going to talk about other movies that we felt like the plot, not so great, but the design...
A plus.
A plus 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 plus. And Simone likes to make fun of me all the time because I, like, tend to like these movies, and then I'll be like, oh, we should watch this movie, it's so good. And then it's, like, not good because the plot's not good, but I'm like, sorry. Just pay attention to all these. Yeah. So one of the movies that Simone likes to make fun of me for all the time is Snow White and the Huntsman.
We also saw this together. Laughing.
We saw this together too, right?
Yes.
We yeah.
Were you there? I don't remember that.
I think I was there.
I don't remember. Because it was. Can we watch the second one? Me and you and Chelsea and. Mm-hmm. So we saw the Snow White and Huntsman 2 together in theaters here. Okay, first of all, this was a bad experience because I think we went into it expecting it to be good. Because yeah. all the trailers Why? Were super misleading.
The trailers.
I don't think they were. I no. saw them and I knew. Like,
the trailers.
I never watched the second one, but I like.
No, we're talking about the second one. We're talking about
yeah.
the second
yeah,
one.
Yeah, the second one. I never saw the second one, but I saw the trailers for it and I just like, I knew that I didn't want to see like, it yeah, based like, on trailers.
First off, the first one, really good. Like,
no
costume design, I
yes.
mean. Like.
I guess, yes.
Actually, you know what? I don't even think the costume design was, like, super, super good for everything, or, like, the set design or whatever. No, the costume designing for Ravenna, just Ravenna. Like, she has, like, 12 costumes in the course of the film. Oh, also, the armor for Snow White in the last battle, it's gorgeous. And, like, she has...
It's like some Alice in Wonderland, like, Tim Burton's Alice
yeah,
in Wonderland.
Yeah, it's
stuff,
really
huh?
similar to that. But... Yeah, no, Ravenna has these incredible raven dresses with, like, these, like, collars with feathers uh-huh. and, like, this. She has, like, these, like, super complicated jewelry with, like, claws and stuff. And it's yeah. all, like, it manages to be, like, look, like, super, like, high fashion modern, but at the same time, like, be historic, like, not historically accurate, but, like, period correct to, like, mm-hmm. the setting.
It fits within, like, the style.
Yeah. Anyway, also it helps that Charlize Theron is, like, super hot. So, like, she looks really good in all of them.
Yeah.
But all the costuming is, like, really nice. And then, of course, we went to go see Snow White and the Huntsman 2, Winter's War, together.
I don't even know how this movie goes. Nobody talked about it.
Let me say, these trailers made it seem like this was a prequel to Snow White and the Huntsman that talks about, like, Ravenna and her sister and how they fought over the kingdom. And that, I was like, cool, like, awesome, like, ice versus, like, gold
yeah.
black, like, that aesthetic, like, super cool, like, that's gonna be a cool battle, right? Guess what? That movie is nothing about that.
Nope.
There's, like, 2 seconds of intro narration that glosses over the entire prequel of what happens, which sounded super interesting, and then they skip to, like, what the heck? I don't even remember anymore.
You can hear how upset Sam is.
It skipped to, well, they did fight at the very end, but it was...
For, like, 2 seconds.
They fought, but the thing is, all their fight scenes were already planned out in the trailer, so you saw all the fight scenes in the trailer. And, like, but it was cut and mishmash in a weird way, where it made it seem that, like, they had to rewrite the endings, like, they had to read a lot of the script after the trailer was made. And it's just, like, the fighting was just, it was just so disjointed, and it was, like, for, like, only like 5 seconds. Yeah. It's like, oh look, we killed Rivera. Oh,
yeah.
Win. Won. And like the rest of the movie is just about like
Chris Hemsworth being in love with his ex-wife who thought he was dead.
What in the world are you watching? Where are you going to the theater for this?
I mean, okay, listen, the plot of the movie is like
not what you want it to be.
No, it's like what happens is like her mirror is lost or something, and so they have to like go on this quest to go find the mirror, but like they run into like Chris Hemsworth's ex-wife, the Huntsman's ex-wife, who like they used to be like, oh, but like, oh, we used to be like Huntsman for the Ice Queen, and she was like, oh, you can't fall in love because falling in love will kill you.
This sounds like a sitcom drama that's gone on for far too long.
So they fall in love and she's like, oh, like, you can't be in love. And she, like, tricks them into thinking that they, like, abandon each other. And they, like, hate each other now. It's so bad. I can't handle it. But the costume design, again, for, like, Emily Blunt's character, whose name I don't remember. It's, like, the sister. Oh, it was Freya.
Yeah,
it was
Freya of the
Norse. Yeah, she was named after the Norse god. I know
that character.
Goddess. Mm-hmm. I mean, she had that, like, mask, that owl mask. Yeah, the
queens were just beautiful.
Yeah, like, she had this, like, gorgeous, like, she, like, could use these ice owls to, like, see the world or whatever, and so she had this, like, mask that she would wear in order to see through, and that was, like, really nice. And, like, I think they really hit on something good in the first movie, where it's that black and gold, like, color palette for Ravenna.
Aesthetic.
Yeah, where she's, like, oil and tar with gold. It was so good.
Just like drop your expensive jewelry into the LeBrand carpets for the aesthetic, guys.
But no, like specifically for Ravenna.
Ravenna.
Yeah. I was mixing Freya and Rivera together, but Ravenna?
Ravenna.
Ravenna, yeah. Ravenna, like a lot of her stuff, like the animation for it, in fact, was actually just like, because what she, like, her costume was like break apart and like, it just looked fantastic. The opening sequence and ending sequence were also really great.
Mm-hmm.
But the animation for her clothes was just, there was so much attention to detail in all of it, but a total lack of attention to detail in the plot.
And then they, like, took a steaming dump all over the entire story.
It's like they had something really, really good of it, and then they were like, oh no, we have to fix this. It has to be about love instead of like these two queens fighting.
Yeah, look, I wanted to see Charlize Theron and Emily Blunt, like, kick the shit out of each other. That's what I wanted.
You know?
And they were like, no, it has to be about how Chris Hemsworth is in love.
And how these movies are, like, the sort of things where I just imagine the creative process for, like, how they're made is that they just go through some costume designers, like, abandoned, like, costume work or, like, just what they made for fun. And they're like, oh, this is good. These actually fit together in, like, kind of a contemporary period. Hey, let's make a movie out of it. Yeah. Out of these costumes.
Oh my god. And you know, I know the screenwriter who worked on this movie, Craig Mazin, I know that he was, like, maybe, like, fourth or fifth out of the screenwriters they hired. So what happens a lot in the movie industry is, like, they'll hire someone to write a script, and then they'll be like, great, thanks, good job. They'll take the script, and then they'll hire someone else to, like, fix it. And then,
or, like, do something different with
yeah,
it.
Or, yeah, and then when they, if they change their mind, they'll hire someone else to do it again. And I know Craig Mazin was, like, really far down the line on this. And so he hosts a script writing podcast with John August. And so every time he'd be like, yeah, so I have this movie coming out. If you want to see, and you could hear he was like kind of dead.
So sad. Oh, that's really too bad. I'm glad that he's self-aware though. As long as the person who made Snow White and the Huntsman 2 is self-aware of what he's done to the world,
I feel like it's not his fault though, because he's that far down the line. Because the trailer really made it seem like these two were gonna kick the shit out of each other and do great. And then they just rewrote it so much that they were like, nope, we're just going to take this snippet, and that's all we're going to use.
Could have been good. Could have been so good.
It
was just think about
it.
It
had all the potential. Even if it was exactly what you wanted it to be, it would just be like an endless battle for no reason. And it would just be like, okay,
no.
It looks cool, but I don't care.
I feel like that's the same thing that people say about Pacific Rim, right? It's like, oh, like it's just like robots and monsters. Like,
but you care about Mako.
Yeah, and I could have cared about...
Dude, this is embarrassing, but when we were at the exhibit and I saw that footage of, like, little Mako, I started crying a little bit. Like, I was like, no.
I teared up a little bit. Because that music was playing in the background. I know, that, like, really dramatic
and I felt really
theme.
Sad.
I think it's Mako's theme from the...
That's, like, the saddest I've been at a movie. I didn't even watch the whole thing. I just saw, like, the 5 seconds, and I was like, I'm suddenly really emotional.
I'm not gonna lie. I saw the screens, and I was just like, I've already seen all these movies. I'm gonna go. Because I just thought that was a mishmash.
Yeah,
it was just a few different movies, So I was like, oh, I've never seen this.
It was a super
cool movie. I want to look at the models.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, I don't remember what happens in some of them either.
I haven't watched, like, a couple of Del Toro movies, like that one that you were excited about, like the people with the really white skin, like whiter than most
Hellboy
white people.
Hellboy 2!
What is that?
Hellboy 2, the Golden
Army. Is that
Army.
Hellboy 2?
It is.
Okay, that's the only one I haven't seen, I think, because I kept saying, what is so this at the good. Exhibit? And you'd be like, oh, it's from Hellboy 2.
It's so good.
The original drawings that he has and like the comics that he has, all the Hellboy stuff. Amazing.
Crazy.
Like, I was standing there just look, like, I put my face, like, right, like, an inch away from it, and, like, you could just see, like, every single detail.
Oh my god, Chelsea kept making me so nervous when we were at the museum, because she'd get super, super close, and I'd be like, Chelsea, you can't touch them. Like, you can't.
Oh, for which ones?
I don't know, some
everything.
Of the paintings. I was like, I, like, grabbed her shoulder, and I was like, hey, Chelsea, you can't, like, but she made me really nervous. I was like, I don't, you can't.
The original Hellboy comic.
Chelsea in the background was saying how she wanted to see the brush strokes.
Anyways, I don't remember a lot of what happens in Pan's Labyrinth because I like noped out halfway through.
Have to finish it. We have to sit Sam
I
down
remember.
And make her finish it because Sam was scared of the Pale Man.
Yeah, I like saw the
Pale
Man. You know, I was like 10 years old when I watched
eyes.
This, and my mom was like, "This is a great idea. Let's watch this movie."
It's one of my favorite movies to rewatch just because every single time you rewatch it, it's just like. You just feel a sense of, like, that childish wonder again.
But
it's
you know, so scary.
I know. I really related to the character.
Everyone loves Pan's Labyrinth so much. You guys are gonna be really mad. But I didn't think that it was, like, that amazing in terms of the story. And, of course, it was good enough where, like, the visuals really carried it. And it was like, okay, I could get into this. But, like, I didn't really care about the character that much. I didn't care about you, Liz.
I'm sorry you didn't care about me. I don't know, I kind of felt it with, like, the whole, like, ah, my mother is sick, and, like, oh, she's gonna, like, ah, I want to help, and, like, the little root thing. Like, that part,
I don't remember any of this.
basically...
There's a little mandrake guy, right?
Yeah, there's a little mandrake guy, and, like, my parents, like, we have, like, jars of, like, ginger that, you keep in wine for, like, hundreds of years or whatever, and every time I would look at that, like, I'd be like, oh, look, the ginger mandrake or whatever, it looks a lot like a baby. And they'd be like, haha, yeah, it does. Exactly that's funny. And then we watch the movie, and I'm like, is that
it's a jar baby.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Mom!
Oh, man. No, yeah, I don't remember half of what happens in Pan's Labyrinth. And I also, segue, I don't remember most of what happens in this other movie that we're going to talk about called 47 Ronin. That was a bad segue. I apologize.
That was a bad. Why did you even introduce that segue?
Look, I tried. I was like, this is a great segue. I literally do not remember any of the plot of 47 Ronin, which is really bad because I guess you guys haven't watched, or you watched 47 Ronin.
I watched 47 Ronin. I don't remember a single thing about it. To be honest, not even the designs.
I literally don't remember what the plot is at
all. I just remember Keanu.
Yeah.
My boy.
But
this is a white, not white, totally.
But. Yeah. You know, half white.
Boy. Whitish dude in Japan. The only one.
It was so, that movie, also beautiful. Like, I can't believe you don't remember it. There's, like, these huge, super wide pano shots of, like a giant, like, gardens with, like, cherry blossoms and, like, the color with, like, these red banners and, like, all of their armor, like, the samurai armor was incredible. It was just
so, I mean, looking at the screenshots that you were showing me earlier today, it looks really good.
I knew going into it, because I know there was this huge controversy before it was coming out.
Of course, because Keanu.
You know, right, because it was like, he's not Japanese. Why do you have to put white people in this movie about Japanese people? And I like went into it expecting it to like not be super great. And so like the plot was whatever, because I don't even remember what the plot was. So I,
it's just people in period Japan
just fighting.
Yeah.
But I just kept stopping myself and being like, wow, like this movie is really pretty. Yeah. Like I didn't expect this at all.
You know what's weird is like, this isn't about specifically 47 Ronin, but like when we're talking about like Japanese period piece movies, for some reason, like, I always think of Memoirs of a Geisha. Like, that movie was really pretty. I saw it when I was in, like, elementary school. Probably not a great idea.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
But, I don't know, my parents didn't care. I watched Pink Floyd when I was, like, 4. It freaked me out forever. Yeah, I don't know. I just, like, I always think of that movie first when it comes to, like, period pieces in, like, Japan. And, like, in Asian countries in general.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say, like, one of the things that I love about, like, movies that bomb... Okay, I looked this up earlier, 47 Ronin apparently did so badly that it lost $152 million.
Awesome.
Like, they spent so much money making it, and they lost... Anyway.
It's because everyone was so mad.
I don't think that was, like, 100%.
I mean,
I think it was, like, they had, like,
that definitely was a contributing factor.
Yeah.
Like, it wouldn't have fit, crashed and burned quite as much.
Yeah.
Which I guess is kind of an interesting thing, because marketing is so important. Like, most people don't think about how marketing affects a movie, but, like, if you look at Kubo and the Two Strings.
Kubo! Oh, man.
Yeah.
What an incredible movie.
An incredible movie, but not doing as well as it should have, because the marketing just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And that's really a shame, because... It,
you know,
deserves a lot of credit.
The thing about it, though, is that, like, if they gave up too... Every time they give away too much of a plot in a movie trailer, it always pisses me off, and I'm like,
No.
I don't actually want to watch a movie anymore. And Kubo, I think that the way that they created their advertisements was really good, because it gave you just enough where it made you curious to watch it, but they didn't have, like, enough of a spread shot of their advertisements. Like, they only showed up really occasionally, and, like...
Yeah,
you know.
I barely saw trailers. You know, I wouldn't even have known about... I wouldn't even have been that hyped for it if Ben hadn't been. Like, Ben was super excited to see it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I was looking
like,
forward to it since I saw the first trailer.
Yeah,
like,
no, I saw the trailer once, and then I kind of forgot about it, because it doesn't... they don't remind you. Like, I didn't see, like, YouTube ads or anything.
See, the thing is, I agree. I don't think... I really don't think that trailers should, like, show any plot. I think it should just be, like... A funny line here, a funny line there.
Yeah.
Like, everything else is just...
I think it should just be, like, like a tease.
A small little taste, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did with Frozen. Do you remember the first trailer for Frozen? It was just the reindeer on, like, the...
God!
The
no! I don't want to ever think about those, like, advertisements ever again. I remember everyone was, like, excited. Like, they're like, oh, they're working on a movie for the Snow Queen. And they're talking about it for years.
Yeah.
And then the first real... the first real trailer we get is like that, and then it's just like mediocre, the movie.
Yeah, whatever. Well, it made $2 billion.
It
so
did.
I don't know if we can really complain about that.
The hype was
I'm not
very
complaining
real
about
super
how
real.
Much money they're making.
Yeah.
I'm complaining about the movie itself.
Yeah.
I just feel like just marketing is just so important, but a lot of people just don't realize.
Yeah. You know, but there's just one thing that I find super interesting about movies that are really gorgeous but bomb, and this might happen to Kubo, which is that After the movie is done and all wrapped up, the studio, a lot of the times, they take a lot of the props and costumes, and after a year or two, they auction them. So movies that bomb and nobody cares about, these costumes go for super, super cheap.
So you're gonna buy all of the Kubo
shoes? I don't know. Maybe not like maybe not cheap as in like $5.
No, of course
like,
not.
Cheaper than normal.
Oh yeah, like way cheaper than like
if like you a couple hundred bucks instead of like thousands.
Oh yeah, like if you look at the Pacific Rim costuming. Yeah, if you look at so there's this website or this or it's called Prop Store basically. That's where a lot of movie props and costumes go to be auctioned afterwards, usually like a year or two, maybe three later. And what happened with Pacific Rim was that, you know, it was like a huge hype, made a lot of money, maybe not like a ton of money, but it was kind of like a cult classic. And so a lot of collectors came after these items. They had the suits, they had the like the full body suits. I saw a helmet alone go for like $10,000. Full suits went for like upwards of like 5-6 figures maybe. It was crazy to watch the auction go on. But I know for a fact, I'll link to a video in the show notes, but Adam Savage bought one of the costumes from 47 Ronin for really cheap. Because it was like, because nobody cared about that movie, right? And all the costumes went up for auction and nobody was looking at them. So we got this like huge, like full body, like really like screen used samurai armor. Yeah, and he like puts it on in the video, and you can see it's like really, really super well made, because it's all like the actors have to wear it when they're acting, right? So it's like actually like rubber and like, but it's painted to all look like metal and wood. So yeah, I don't know, we can keep an eye out. So I think if Kubo doesn't do well, yeah, it's possible that a lot of the stuff might go up for auction for cheap.
You said Pacific Rim was a cult classic, but that was like, I thought that was a huge hit.
I think it was a big hit, but I don't think it made, like, $1 billion the way Frozen did.
Huh. Well, I mean,
yeah.
It was definitely... I'm just disappointed in Frozen.
Sorry that Frozen general. Had to come up.
Yeah.
It definitely did well, but it's definitely not like a, ah, you broke the world record. I'm like, ah.
Yeah.
It's like every movie breaks the box office record. Every single one.
I mean, it's not like a Marvel movie, right? Where like they like put $1 million into it and they get $1 billion out of it.
Of course.
So, yeah. But yeah, everyone loves
just throwing some quippy lines and you got yourself a Marvel movie.
And I mean, everyone after Pacific Rim, you know, everyone was like talking smack about it. They're like, oh, it's just like robots and monsters hitting each other, and they're like, sorry, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people I talked to who were like, you liked that movie? I was like, yeah, that movie was incredible. Like, did you not see what I saw?
I feel like the sound was just incredible for that movie too.
Oh yeah, you have to watch that in IMAX. You gotta. Like the huge
sound design?
Oh yeah.
We should just watch it at my parents' house with the horrifying surround sound that scared Sam.
Yeah, I know. It's scary, okay?
My house is scary.
Anyways, so that's a lot of fun. And by the way, if you ever go on Prop Store, you can like spend hours there just looking at the auctions that go up. Like, oh man, you know what another good movie is? That didn't do well and also was badly written, but was really pretty.
So it wasn't a good movie. It just
Ender's Game. Did you see Ender's Game?
I did see Ender's Game.
We saw Ender's Game together.
We saw Ender's Game together.
We snuck in.
The CG segment with, like, the game, that is, like, I wanted to play that video game after I watched that movie. It was really, really interesting, and it was the most interesting part of interesting part of the movie for me.
Yeah.
But it's just,
bless.
I didn't think of the design other than that was that.
No, I really liked the, you know, the battle room?
Yeah.
That huge, and the floating, like, sphere with, like, and they had these suits that they wore. Mm-hmm. I forgot what they're called exactly. But those suits went up for auction on Prop Store. Also really cheap.
Sam, is it just, like, your homepage, Prop Store?
No. No, I only go there, like, once every couple months, because I know that if I go there, I'll get lost. And I, like, won't be able to find my way.
You'll never be found again.
Yeah. But, you know, it was super, like, Ender in the movie, his mom has like she's in the movie for like 2 seconds, but she wears this like really cool outfit because she's like a super chic mom, right? And I looked and her outfit was on sale, and it was like this, it was full outfit, like shirt, shoes, pants, and it was going for like $60.
You should have bought it,
right? And you know, I saw, and it was describing what each of the items were, and it was like name brand you know, like, items, like, the shoes were, like,
you could just go to the Nordstrom and buy the outfit.
No, but the thing is, like, if you had gone to, like, Nordstrom to buy this, it would have been, like, $100, $300 to, like, buy all that stuff. It was just going for $60. I mean, obviously, it probably would have been, like, the size you were looking for, but, like, it's just interesting that these things, like, come up even cheaper than you'd expect them to be. But, yeah, Ender's Game. That was, good source material, and then they had to go and, like, mess it all up with the movie.
Well, there was also Orson Scott Card being...
Yeah, that was,
being an interesting
That's
person.
Why we snuck into the movie.
Of course.
Oh, wait, guys, don't tell them your illegal antics.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, from 2 or 3 years ago? We definitely They're gonna come after us, the theater police!
We definitely didn't buy tickets for, Gravity and then walk into the Ender's Game theater instead.
Yeah.
I watched Ender's Game... when it was running on TV, just, like, randomly.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's no, such a good pick, I would, though. I would support any Inuyasha film over, that.
Yeah. Orson Scott Card.
Orson Scott Card.
Extraordinaire.
Yeah.
What a great.
On a side note, I would love to see a movie done for Dune.
Again, oh, you mean you know, a movie done again?
A good one. Hold on, I don't believe in that.
We all three of us have to watch Jodorowsky's Dune, because that, like, is a documentary all about, like, Jodorowsky and his vision for what it should be.
Peter Hahn was just talking about this in class, because one person's redesign project is this alien spaceship thing. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. I love her redesign project, but she was designing a spaceship, mm-hmm. and Peter Hahn was saying, yeah, you should go watch this documentary, because a lot of the designs that are in there look mm-hmm. a lot like this, and you can be really helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, he hired, like, Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
Like, a bunch of insane, like, and never ended up actually making the movie, so it was like...
Yeah, well, because it was way too ambitious.
Yeah.
Like, he was I want to do this.
He was way too far.
He was way ahead of the curve.
I think,
Too far.
I think if he tried that, I think if he tried to do that now, he would probably be successful, but back then it was just...
Mm-hmm.
Of course. It was just, like, way too hard. Didn't he hire Ridley Scott to work on that a bit?
Oh, shoot. Who designed the alien?
Ridley Scott.
No. His designer. What was the artist's name? I've already forgotten. That's really embarrassing.
You call yourself an artist?
You don't even remember the guy that made the alien thing. Yeah. He hired all of these, like, crazy high-profile artists to design Dune.
We really need to watch that.
Totally, barely related, but have you seen the Twitter account that takes quotes from Dune and replaces them with pumpkins, replaces the word spice with pumpkin spice?
No!
Oh no! What the hell?
You have to send this to me.
The spice turned you blue. Turned your eyes blue. Oh shit, the pumpkin spice turned your eyes blue.
Yeah.
No!
It's so mad. It's incredible.
Oh, that's dumb.
The Spice Wars.
It's just like hipster girls instead of
aliens.
Instead of aliens, yeah. The aliens are all hipsters are aliens.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sam. We're gonna take you away on our
stage. They were in space before it was cool, guys.
Yeah. With guys that have the sides of their head shaved and wear glasses that don't have a prescription.
Oh,
what a mess. We kind of got sidetracked a little
bit. Yeah, just a little bit.
Speaking of aliens, want to talk about Star Wars?
Star Wars prequels.
I tried. Disclaimer. I tried.
Yeah, that, you know.
Close enough.
I wasn't willing to even acknowledge that it happened.
We're going to talk about the prequels now.
We are going to talk about the prequels. By the way, disclaimer, I don't like the designs in the prequel movies. I can understand why other people would like them, but personally, they just, like, don't... I don't... Like, and it's mostly because they don't fit with the world at all. Like, it doesn't feel like Star Wars, and it's just like, some weird... It feels like a Del Toro movie.
Yeah.
Harsh words.
But it works with Del Toro because it's like a completely... Yeah. That's a different conversation. Sam, go.
I just wanted to talk about Ian McKaig. Because Ian McKaig is incredible.
Yeah.
But, everyone agrees, like, the only good thing about the prequels with Darth Maul and his double-ended lightsaber. Come on.
I thought that was dumb, even though
they're just... Wait.
They just made him look like Alien Satan.
Alien Satan?
But also a tiger. Alien Tiger Satan, you know, with a Ian double McKay, blade, and he gets chopped in half.
Ian McKay reportedly was inspired by clowns to create Darth Maul.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He talks about it in his book. I have like, Shadowline, which is Ian McKay's book. Super, it's like this huge book. It's way bigger than I thought it would be. This book's like $60, but I got it at Half Price Books. It was really good. I love that book. But he has, he has a lot of the concept art he did for Star Wars, the prequels, in there. And I mean, I love the Queen Amidala designs and the Padme outfits.
You know, there was one part that I always thought was cool. Is I always liked how they did her lipstick. Like, I always thought, like, the design of her lipstick was, like, kind of...
Yeah, and she... But she had, like, she had so many costumes. Mm-hmm. Like, every single time you saw her, she had to have a costume change. But yeah, just like the way her hair was done and like these like crazy, like her funeral procession, that was in the prequels, right? Yeah, that was like incredible. Like just really like beautiful. Yeah, I know. Yeah, Lindsay showed us a drawing. Picture
from
Ian McKaig.
Yeah, Ian McKaig. I have his, it's just so good. And his, I mean, it also helps that Ian McKaig is like an incredible artist and all of his drawings look super good. So you also are like, wow, what a good drawing.
Yeah.
So that's
I mean, I can see why it appeals to people, but it's just like and my main problem with it was that it just didn't, like, it felt like a completely different universe. Like,
you
it
know,
did not
he did kind of just disregard like the thing about Star Wars is that like it's like
it's really simplistic.
It's like post like grandeur.
Yeah.
You know? It's like the original trilogy was all about, like, you know, all these, like, beat up, like...
It all feels fighters. Really lived in.
Everything is really lived in. And then when he went to go do the prequels, he was like, spend a lot of money, make some big, you know, matte paintings, and just go to hell with it.
And I think my problem with, like, a lot of... Because, you know, a lot of these movies we're talking about, they have, like, this whole grand thing. My problem with, like, some of the designs, and especially with the prequels, is that, like, it's just that environments don't feel lived in at all. Like, Crimson Peak is an exception. Like, it does feel lived in. And so that's, like, that done right, where it has, like, all of these elaborate designs. But it also, like, feels like a real world. It's not just, like, you know, beautiful for the sake of being beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's, like, a real... It feels like a real place to a degree. Mm-hmm. Their prequels don't have that at all. It just has, like, weird CG backgrounds that are, like, totally pristine and completely empty.
And Gungans.
And a lot of Gungans. Why are there so many Gungans?
Any other movies that you want to talk about? Movies that you think were really, you know, like, bad movies with good design?
You know, I think The Hobbit had some good designs.
I haven't watched The Hobbit, actually. I can't say it's a bad movie or not.
I don't know. I'm so torn about The Hobbit, honestly. Because on one hand, it was like...
Yeah, I read that book as a kid. I didn't read Lord of the Rings. I didn't like the movies of Lord of the Rings. I didn't like the books. But I, like, loved The Hobbit growing up for some reason. It was weird.
I don't know. Like, there are some good designs. Like, you know, the one thing that they really did good about The Hobbit is that they saved all the concept artwork and they, like... put it together into, like, 6 volumes, right, of, like, the art and design of The Hobbit. These, like, it was just, they had, like, ones for Smaug, they had ones for, like, they had 2 for Desolation of Smaug that was, like, all about, and they had these, you know, like, all of the pencil drawings, all of the, like, paintings, and they, like, sold them for, like, you know, the books were, like, not that expensive.
Yeah.
And so they made this really accessible for people to see, you know, the production that went into this. Which was, I think, you know, they did really good on that.
Yeah.
I wish they would do that with more movies.
Yeah,
I agree. Know?
It feels like a lot of movies, they kind of just keep their concept art very, like, secretive. They're like,
it's
like,
not even secretive. It's just, like, they don't really think about it afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, it's not important to them afterwards because they've already used it for what they were going to use it for.
Well, there's also a lot of privacy rights that go on when you're a concept artist and artist there.
Yeah,
so
there's a,
true.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, IP stuff.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the work, you know, belongs to the studio. And the studio, like, they just, like, don't care about it after the movie's done.
Yeah, I really wish that they just put it out because...
Yeah. I wish they would just do what they did with The Hobbit. Like, literally, Weta Workshops. They knew that people would be into this stuff.
Yeah.
And so they were like, well, we're going to make books, and we're going to sell them, and
we're going to make $1 million, yeah.
Because, like, a lot of people bought these books.
I feel like for any movie, like, even for Crimson Peak, if Crimson Peak put out an art book, I would have bought
one. I would buy that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Like,
You know, I saw, like, on the, in the museum, there were, like, books full of, like, concept art sitting on the tables. Like, really? There was one for Crimson Peak.
Really? Wait,
what? Yeah, I think they
is
probably...
Is there an Art of Crimson Peak book?
I think there is. Okay. I mean, I don't know if it says Art of Crimson... It said Crimson Peak on the cover.
I'm gonna buy it right now if it's available.
I took a picture of some of the books that was on the table. I know that one of the books was, like, oh, like, an anthology of, like, all these, like, mythical... Yeah, it's the Man, Myth, and Magic, and it's just about a bunch of, like, magical creatures.
I saw, demon summoning circles in there. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? I had something to say. Oh, no, the, like, problem that I have with a lot of these is because, like, you know, people will say, like, I'll say, oh, you know, I think the design was really good, and people will like, oh, but it looks, like, so unrealistic. Mm. And my problem... with that is that the design and, like, the actual way that the cinematography is, like, done are, like, two very different things. And it feels like it's not very common where those two things actually coincide where, like, you know, it feels justified. A lot of the times, like, so I'll be like, oh, I really like how this movie looks. And they're like, really? It looked so fake. And I'm like, yeah, I know it looked fake and, like, the CG looked bad and whatever, but the design itself was what was interesting to me. And, like, you know, I feel, there's all this, like, justifying that I feel like I have to do when I talk about these bad movies. I'm like, oh man, that movie looked great. And they're like, that was the worst movie ever. And I'm like, I know, right?
But look at it.
It's just like, people who go to watch movies normally are not going to pay attention to that kind of stuff. Like, because they don't know to look for it. Like, on the first level, they're just paying attention to what the story is. And if people can't get that right, like, if the director and the writers can't get it right, then you've already lost their audience.
And I still think that that is the most important aspect. So it is justified, but, like, it's just frustrating when people don't understand that. I mean, no, I don't think that the movie was good. It's the worst. Yeah. It's just, I like how certain
aspects
of it.
Like, I'd rather flip through screenshots of this movie than watch it.
Yeah, I tried to look for screenshots of it, actually.
Of Crimson Peak?
Not of Crimson... I actually should do that. But I was looking for Snow White and the Huntsman. Like,
Because
I wanted to see Freya's and, like...
Yeah,
did costumes. You just find movie posters, basically?
No, I only found the first one. I was like, this is nice. But, like, I want to see the gold and the black.
There's some other movies, I think, that also fall into that category. Life of Pi.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a fan of the plot of that movie. I mean,
I thought that was a given that it was just a bad plot. And, like, the part at the end...
I feel like it was bad. I think it was just unoriginal.
Which makes it bad. It's not a new story.
Not particularly progressive.
Okay, never mind. The main problem that I have with that movie's story is that, like, at the very end, like, other than it starting out with, like, something that didn't even have any bearing on the rest of the movie because it, like, didn't come back to, like, actually become relevant in the parts where you were actually interested in, at the very end, because it's, like, all about the open for interpretation thing where it's, like, oh, you know, these animals symbolize the people that he actually, like, you know, spoiler alert, it symbolized the people that he actually, like, you know, was marooned with on this raft, and then they just directly say that, and it's like, that's supposed to be something that you think about afterwards. You're not supposed to just say, oh, by the way, I went kind of crazy and this is like how I dealt with it.
I don't know, the part with the whale in the bioluminescent water,
I just thought it was, like, I'm over the top. There's some things where, like, it's supposed to look good visually, but, like, I feel like it's too much, and it kind of disconnects from reality to the point where I can't really take it seriously anymore.
It's like when you see photos of, like, beaches, right? And then it's like, wow, that's, like, a really nice beach, but it's a photo of a beach, and it looks so fake that I don't actually care anymore.
Yeah, or, like, those giant, like, really impressive paintings of, like, you know, like, giant creatures or whatever, and you're like, wow... Or, you know, those things, Birds for Scale, just look at Birds for Scale, the subreddit, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. Like, those, like, you think they're impressive, but there's nothing about them that you generally find, like, particularly interesting. It's just that they're, like,
they're just good
impressive.
There's no, like, deeper personal connection that you have with it.
Yeah. They're just really well painted.
Yeah.
anyway, that was our... obviously pretty passionate about all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all of the movies for now. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go on to our One Cool Things? Simone has a...
I have a really good
stunningly
one.
Relevant One Cool Thing.
Okay, so... that site that Sam was talking about, the props one, what is it called?
Prop store.
Prop store. A while ago, they were selling Senator Palpatine's forehead from the original movies. It was original Star Wars trilogy.
I think there was a Phil Tippett auction. So Phil Tippett, who was a special effects guy, he did prosthetics, makeup, animatronics. He recently went through his collection and he found a lot of stuff that he was willing to auction out. And so a bunch of original Star Wars drawings, original Star Wars pieces, also other things he worked on, like...
so it was all this cool stuff about Star Wars, but the number one most expensive thing during that auction was a prosthetic for Senator Palpatine's forehead. Yeah. So that was great.
It looks like a butt.
It went for $7,000. Yeah. It looks like a butt, and it's amazing.
I don't think it was the most expensive thing. But
no, it was like at the very top.
One of the most expensive things out of this Star Wars. Because I know there was a RoboCop full cane.
I didn't even see that.
Yeah, there was a cane.
Oh my god.
They had a full size cane from RoboCop that was selling. So I'm pretty sure that went for a lot. Yeah. But yeah, the Senator Palpatine forehead prosthetic was $7,000. Not something that you could ever. I'm like, plus if you like displayed this thing, like it just looks like a shriveled up butt. So
it looks like the butt of like a 120-year-old. Yeah.
So if you like displayed it, people would be like, what's that? Like what? So it's not exactly visually appealing on it by itself.
And did they like this is a prosthetic that you put on your forehead just to make okay.
Mm-hmm. The actor had to put it on and it's not like anyone's ever gonna wear it again.
I just want to know what these people are doing with it. Like, I want to know if they put it on themselves.
They're putting it on display in, like, a well-lit black
I
box.
I
want to
see someone else glass. Wearing it.
No, it's just, like, collectors, people who collect. Like, oh my gosh, so there's this
what
great...
what if they want to wear it? Like,
you know, somebody who wanted to wear it, like, they wouldn't take it so seriously that they would spend $7,000 on
That's
it.
That's very true.
Yeah.
No, unfortunately.
There's this fantastic story of, so while they were doing the new Star Wars movie, while they were planning for Force Awakens, they wanted to have a holochest set segment, you know, where they had the holochest turn on, and, you know, they could have just, like, done CG or whatever, but they were like, no, we gotta make this, like, authentic, because, you know, J.J. Abrams is a huge nerd. So what he ended up doing was he hired a lot of really, like, master special effects guys to recreate the original. So originally it was done using stop motion, so he hired Frank Ippolito, a bunch of people at Phil Tippett Studios to recreate the original maquettes to reshoot a new stop motion sequence for the holochest set. They obviously spent like a bunch of money on this and it was only on screen for like 2 seconds. But what happened was the team, they were trying to find the originals, the original puppets or the original pieces.
I mean, it was claymation, right?
No, it wasn't. It was like stop motion with armature and it was all cast and molded, which is why they ended up bringing Frank Ippolito on board because he ended up being master mold maker. So he did these really super complicated, like 8-part matrix molds. Anyways, so they were looking for the original props and they found a couple of them. There was like 2 of them that were in the Lucasfilm archives and they were looking for the other ones and they couldn't find them until someone, I guess, just called up Weta Workshops and they were like, oh yeah, Peter Jackson has them.
His
personal collection.
He just
has 3 of them, like, in his own collection, and so he ended up taking those to Weta Workshops and they had them 3D scanned really high res and sent to the team so they could have them 3D printed and remolded. But you know, like, it just reminded me of Guillermo del Toro, because, you know, he just, like, buys all
he
of
just
this
buys
random
stuff,
and, you know, like, you bet Peter Jackson was just, like, strolling around one day, and someone was like, hey, do you want to buy the original, holochest set from Star Wars? And he was like, yeah, buy
of course.
That, and then put it in this room, like, anyway, crazy. That's great.
I would love to have that kind of money.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd actually spend, like, that much money on props.
No, but it'd
stuff.
Be nice to have that money.
I cannot disagree with that.
Alright, so my one cool thing this week, I was just talking about Peter Hahn earlier because we were talking about Peter Hahn's class, but I recently saw on Instagram, Peter Hahn, the legend, is giving away this enormous 28-foot drawing of Godzilla that he did this drawing live for a gallery show or something, and then afterwards, I guess they didn't really want it anymore, and so he got to take it.
Why would you not want that?
I don't know. Anyway, so he has it, and it was, like, lying around, and he's moving right now, so he can't hold on to it, and so he was saying on Instagram, he's like, hey, if anybody wants this for free, and obviously, like, 1 million people. Of course. He's like, yeah, I can't ship it, but if you're in the LA area, you can, like, just come get it or something, and, you know, like, 1 million.
Is it just, like, people. A race to his house?
I don't know, and, like, yeah, no, everyone was commenting on Instagram, they're like, I'll take it, and I saw this, there's hilarious comments that are like, I live in Italy, but if you pick me, I'll fly all the way from Italy to come get it or something, but he is not just giving it away now because there are so many people that want it.
Yeah, of course.
So what is actually going to happen is he is going to have a raffle for it at CTN, mm-hmm. which is happening next week, 2 weeks from now. But basically, he's going to be at CTN and he's going to raffle off this piece, this 9-foot by 28-foot drawing of Godzilla. But that is my one cool thing. So if you are interested in getting an original Peter Hahn drawing for free,
go fast.
28-foot one, no less. You better be at CTN to get those raffle tickets, my friends. Yeah, all right, Lindsay, you want to do your one cool thing to close us up?
Yes. So my one cool thing is David Attenborough, but specifically Planet Earth 2 is coming out, and it's already out in the UK. And so the link in the show notes is a scene that has been circulating
incredible.
Around. Incredible scene about lizards and snakes. And I won't spoil anything, but you should just go and watch it. Unless you don't want to spoil Planet Earth 2.
Spoiler alert for a documentary.
Hey, that, yeah. Well, that seems suspenseful.
Yeah.
Hey, some documentaries have things that spoil.
Honestly, we were just watching this video before, and we were joking about how there's more plot in this 6-minute video than there is in the entirety of Crimson Peak. So, just...
Or Snow and the Huntsman.
It's more compelling.
It's much Definitely. More compelling.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible. You should watch it. Yeah. You should watch Planet Earth.
All of David Attenborough's stuff is pretty amazing, actually. Yeah. Just anything that he does, just put him on and fall asleep.
That's a
legend. Let him talk to you to sleep.
Yeah.
Just so soothing, so amazing.
His old British man voice.
It's really good.
I love
It's a really great voice.
Yeah, it is.
If you ever have a bad day, that's what you should do.
Yeah. David Attenborough, my grandfather.
I wish. Oh, imagine. I'd just be like, oh, grandfather, tell me about the lizards and snakes again.
Tell me the story about that one time.
Do you think he has grandchildren? Do you think he reads them bedtime stories?
If my grandpa was David Attenborough,
I would want that.
I would make him, like, narrate my life.
That'd be
so I would just be like, Grandpa, follow me to the store. Grandpa.
It would be so amazing, though. He'd be like, and here is Simone, picking through the different varieties of cereal. What an amazing shot.
Yeah. Just nature at its finest. Anyway.
An amazing man, amazing documentaries that are coming out. You should definitely look at Planet Earth 2. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't seen Planet Earth 1, you should definitely go and look at that.
So, those are our one cool things for this week. If any of them interest you, you can find links in the show notes and follow those and check them out. If you have questions, comments, concerns, if you want to complain about Star Wars prequels, you can email us at negspacepodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you own the email address negativespacepodcast@gmail.com, please contact me so I can have it. I don't understand what you're doing with it.
Have you tried to email them?
No, I haven't.
You should.
It's a good idea.
That is a great idea.
I mean, who wants negativespacepodcast@gmail.com? That's so specific.
If they have the podcast named Negative Space.
I don't know.
Can you do Podcast Negative Space?
Podcast Negative Space. We'll see. Anyway, it's negspacepodcast@gmail.com.
NEG.
Yep. And you can find the show notes at samanthashay.com/negative-space. Oh yeah, it's Samantha last and my last name is shieh.com/negative-space. Hope you all have a great day.
I don't.
Bye.
Bye.